Hello, welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Luke Thompson, the host of the channel. Today I'll be speaking with Jacob Dalton about his recent book, The Taming of the Demons, Violence and Liberation in Tibetan Buddhism, published by Yale University Press in 2011. This book examines violence, both symbolic and otherwise, in Tibetan Buddhism. Dalton focuses in particular on the Age of Fragmentation, here 842 to 986, and draws on previously unexamined Dunhuang manuscripts to show that this period was one of great creativity and innovation, and a time when violent myths and rituals were instrumental in adapting Buddhism to local interests, thereby allowing Buddhism to firmly establish itself in Tibet. While much 20th century scholarship faithfully followed Tibetan historiography's assertion that the Age of Fragmentation was a dark time during which the light of Buddhism faded completely, Dalton not only confirms that Buddhism continued throughout this period, but also looks to the Dunhuang materials to show that it was in fact the Age of Fragmentation narratives of demon taming that laid the groundwork for the emergence of a new pan-Tibetan Buddhist identity beginning in the 11th century. Central to Dalton's project are a myth and a ritual. The myth is that of the subjugation of the demoness Rudra, in which a compassionate but wrathful Buddhist deity violently defeats the wild Rudra, using a means that Buddhism condemns, violence, and yet is used as a force for good in this case. This narrative encapsulates a theme that runs throughout the book, the Buddhist ambivalence towards violence, an ambivalence present in the tradition from its earliest days, but which found its fullest expression in Tantric Buddhism. The ritual, on the other hand, is the so-called liberation ritual, in which a victim, usually an effigy is prescribed, is ritually murdered and then purified. Dalton focuses in particular on a Dunhuang ritual manual, which, incidentally, makes no mention of an effigy, thus leaving some doubt as to whether or not the manual intends an actual human victim. This rite and the story of Rudra constitute a pair of sorts, and together served as a theoretical, historical, mythic, and practical model whereby the native evil demons of Tibet could be tamed, i.e. ritually murdered and purified, and employed in the service of Buddhism. Dalton also demonstrates how the themes of violence and demon taming continued beyond the Age of Fragmentation. For example, a composite work called the Pillar Testament, late 11th to mid-12th century, contains a legend in which the 7th century king Songtsen Gampo had to subjugate the land of Tibet, envisioned as, and thus identified as none other than, a huge Rakshasi demoness lying on her back, by pinning this demoness down with 13 temples. In this way, the legend carries the model of demon subjugation that was used at the local level during the Age of Fragmentation to a national level during the Second Imperial period. Later on, as Tibetans ceased to think of their own evil nature and autochthonous demons as the greatest threat to Buddhism, and instead shifted their attention to peoples and powers at the periphery of their realm, the same model of demon subjugation was applied, with Tibet's perceived enemies, particularly the Mongols, taking the role of sacrificial victim. The book's content is wide-ranging yet skillfully woven together through the dual themes of violence and liberation, i.e. demon subjugation. Along the way, we hear about the differences between Chinese and Tibetan receptions of Buddhist scriptural attitudes towards violence, Padmasambhava as a demon tamer, the Indian Kalika Purana, King Yesheo's late 10th century attempts to prohibit the liberation rite, the 5th Dalai Lama's use of demon-quelling rites for military success, and 18th, 19th, and 20th century British and Tibetan views and condemnations of what appear to be sacrificial rituals. These are but a few of the many topics covered in this book's 7 chapters. 3 appendices provide a translation of the Rudra myth, as well as transcriptions, translations, and transliterations of 2 liberation rite manuals from Dunhuang. This book will be particularly valuable to those researching or interested in violence and religion, Tibetan historiography, the importance of Dunhuang materials in the study of pre-modern Tibet, the relationship between Buddhism and autochthonous deities, the use of myth in the construction of Buddhist identity and history, and 19th and 20th century Western views of Tibet. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies. I'm Luke Thompson, the host of the channel. Today I'm with Jacob Dalton, and we're going to be talking about his new book, The Taming of the Demons: Violence and Liberation in Tibetan Buddhism, published by Yale University Press in 2011.
This book was shortlisted for the 2012 American Academy of Religion Book Award in the Historical Study of Religion category. It won the 2013 E. Jean Smith Book Prize on Inner Asia, given by the Association of Asian Studies, China, and Inner Asia Councils. And it also won the 2013 Bernard S. Cohn Book Prize, sponsored by the Association of Asian Studies, South Asia Council. Jacob Dalton is Associate Professor and Khyentse Foundation Distinguished Professor of Tibetan Buddhism at the University of California, Berkeley, with appointments in the Department of South and Southeast Asian Studies and also in the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultures. Jacob Dalton, welcome to the show, and thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks, Luke. Thanks for having me.
No. Pleasure's mine. So I was wondering if you could just begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself, where you're from, how you came to the study of Tibet and or Buddhism, any important influences in your life, for example, mentors, academic advisors?
Yeah, sure. I first encountered Buddhism as an undergraduate at Amherst College. And at the time, when I was a freshman, Robert Thurman was just in his last year before moving to Columbia. And I took a course on Introduction to Religions. And he taught one little segment of the course on Buddhism, and it sort of caught my interest. And the very next year, Janet Gyatso started at Amherst. And so I enrolled in courses with her all year. And it was sort of around this time that I was also starting to question, like a sort of typical undergraduate does, and getting interested in philosophy. So at the same time as I was taking that year of courses with Janet, I was also enrolled in a year-long sequence on Western political philosophy. And so I was at first sort of interested in comparative philosophy and getting very excited about Buddhist philosophy. And then I took some time off from college and ended up doing a study abroad program with Hubert Desclerc and the SIT program, which has sort of hosted a lot of undergrad students who went on to do PhDs in Tibetan studies. So that was in that was the spring semester of 1990. And it was on that trip that I was shocked to discover that this isn't just an abstract philosophy, but there are actually people sitting in caves and so on doing these practices. And that just blew me away, and I realized I wanted to spend the rest of my life going back and forth to Asia and having a real reason to be there. And so I then went on and finished my BA, not at Amherst, but at a tiny college called Marlborough College in Vermont. And then, yeah, ended up doing my PhD at Michigan under Donald Lopez, my MA and PhD in Buddhist studies. And gradually my interests moved from the philosophical more toward ritual and the history of ritual, which is kind of what I guess characterizes a lot of my work since completing my PhD. It's still philosophy lurks in the background, but it's ritual in particular, and the ways that Buddhist philosophy kind of is instantiated in ritual and how that changes over time. And do you want me to continue on with my autobiography beyond my PhD, or shall I stop there for now?
Yeah, well, we can. Do you mean in terms of the work you've pursued since getting your PhD?
Yeah.
No, you can stop there. That's good. Okay. Thank you very much. A lot of your previous work, not all of it, obviously, has, but before this 2011 book, and of course, you've got another one about to come out, I guess, in 2015. But prior to The Taming of the Demons, a lot of your work focused on cataloging the Stein collection of the Dunhuang manuscripts held at the British Library. So how did you come to write your second book and your first book, which co-authored book, was on that? But how did you come to write your second book on the theme of violence in Tibetan Buddhism?
Yeah, so it's a slightly unorthodox path. So my PhD was on this one Nyingma Tantra and its whole history from its inception in the 9th century right through to the present day. So that's normally people's first book is their PhD reworked, but that's actually the book that's coming out with Columbia in another year or something.
I see. But
so after I finished my PhD, I got what amounted to kind of a postdoc position for 3 years working with the International Dunhuang Project at the British Library. And I was working very closely with Sam Bunskayak, who's a dear friend and colleague. Our job was to catalog the tantric manuscripts in the Stein collection, meaning the manuscripts they found in the library cave at Dunhuang.
Mm-hmm. By tantric in this case, does that mean all the ones in Tibetan or
yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Focusing on the Tibetan in particular. So the Stein manuscripts from Dunhuang were originally cataloged by Louis de Lévelet-Poussin during World War I. But at the time, you know, tantric studies was basically non-existent. And so if you look at his catalog, it's, you know, as one might expect, incredibly well-informed about sutric Buddhism. But when it came to the tantric manuscripts, he just says sort of mantras and moves on to the next entry. So IDP had applied for a grant to digitize a lot of the Tibetan tantric manuscripts and then hired me as a full-time cataloger to read through all of them and write descriptive entries. So that was just this incredibly lucky opportunity where for 3 years I just had free run of the British Library and my own interests fit very well with what the IDP wanted of me. So no one ever said a word to me that I should be doing anything different than what I was. And Sam and I just had a great 3 years gradually coming to terms with reckoning with the tantric manuscripts, which, you know, to start out, neither of us were very well prepared to stand at all. But it was great having a partner in crime, and we gradually worked our way through the collection.
Yeah.
And so that produced the catalog. And then I have a couple of other book projects that kind of grew out of that. So the first one was this book on violence that's the subject of this interview.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically happened because actually, I had outstanding a translation from my PhD research of the most elaborate version of the Taming of Rudra myth, in which the Buddhas sort of take on a violent form and kill Rudra, this demon of primordial ignorance. So I had that and didn't use it for my PhD, but had it lurking in the background. And then as I was reading through these Dunhuang manuscripts, I came across one manuscript in particular, but then later began to realize there are a couple of manuals in addition describing a similar rite. But this manuscript contained instructions for what's known as the liberation rite or drowa rite, where one usually takes an effigy and sort of calls the soul of one's enemy into the usually a demon into the effigy and destroys the effigy, thereby sort of, you know, causing harm to the person. And so it's kind of the ritual pair to the myth of, you know, Rudra's taming. So you have this myth ritual pairing that with the myth justifying the violent the use of violent means by the Buddhas, and then a ritual for how to reenact that myth by, you know, directing a violent activity toward some demonic force.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And so I sort of was surprised by how explicit some of these manuals were. I hadn't encountered this kind of material before, and thought increasingly of this myth ritual pair as a nice, they complemented each other nicely. Mm-hmm. And then gradually that grew into a book of where I was just kind of trying to come to terms with what these two texts meant and how they affected Tibetan Buddhist culture and history through the ages. So that the book sort of starts with those two texts as a jumping off point and then moves through Tibetan history, tracing some of the themes that are in them through different moments in Tibetan history.
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically what the book is about.
I see. So getting into the book itself, the first thing I wanted to mention is just about sources. It seems like one of this book makes many contributions to the field of Tibetan Buddhist studies, but one of the most original, it seems, one of the original ones, it seems, would be the use of these Dunhuang manuscripts. And you mentioned in the beginning of the book that these really haven't been used very much. And I was just wondering if you could say one word about why that is that they haven't been used.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of work that's been done on them in the form of articles.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a large collection to have the time to read through would be difficult. And, in general, at both the British Library and the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, where half of the collection sits, you have to call up one manuscript at a time and it's very laborious. So
I see.
It was partly just how fortunate this opportunity was that I suddenly had free run of the library and could go down and bring up as many manuscripts as I want whenever I wanted.
Yeah.
And having the free time of 3 years to just read through them gave me a kind of a larger vision of the collection as a whole.
I see.
So in that way, it enabled me to kind of... In fact, each of the three book projects that have grown out of that cataloging work that I'm working on, I see them as together kind of providing a larger vision of the significance of the collection as a whole in a way that just for pragmatic reasons hadn't been possible before.
Right. So moving on into the introduction, we already, in the introduction, you write that the history of violence in Tibet is rooted in a fundamental pairing of myth and ritual, the myth of the demon Rudra's subjugation and the euphemistically named liberation rite. We've already discussed these a bit, but these are central to the book, so I just wanted to, these are very central to the book, so I wanted to point these out. And the myth of the demon Rudra is basically the story of the demon Rudra, who in a former life was a disciple of a Buddhist monk who misunderstood this monk's teachings, was angered and banished this monk, his teacher, and then descended into a life of hedonism, eventually descending into Avicii hell, but then through a moment's reflection on his past evil deeds, he begins to ascend towards better realms until he's eventually born as a human. But as a human, however, he is particularly evil and eventually becomes the leader of all the beasts and demons on the island of Lanka, which is where he's born. And anyway, it's a quite an elaborate story, but eventually the Rudra is defeated by the Heruka Buddha, who swallows him and purifies the demon inside his belly. So correct me if I'm wrong, but here you've got sort of two parties who are both engaged in violence, Rudra and then the Heruka. But one is doing it sort of in a way that is sanctioned by tantric Buddhism, and one is doing it not in that way. Is that okay? And then the liberation rite, as you described, is this sort of usually involving an effigy in which you sort of sacrifice the victim, but for the benefit of the victim. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so we'll discuss those a bit more as we go. But moving on to chapter one, you discuss the history of compassionate violence in Buddhism, and although the apparently oxymoronic concept of compassionate killing may have found its most explicit expression in the tantras, you note that from early on, Buddhism acknowledged the moral complexity of violence, and that this began to be further developed in Mahayana Buddhism, in which there was a greater emphasis on intention than there was on adherence to monastic codes or, say, behavioral norms. So I was wondering if you could just discuss this this sort of doctrinal backdrop of Buddhist attitudes towards and ambivalence about violence.
Yeah, so as you say, the ambivalence around violence is sort of one of the main themes that I trace through the whole book. And you said that that in a way, the Buddha and Rudra in the myth are both involved in violence, but somehow the Buddha's violence is compassionate and good, whereas Rudra's is demonic and evil.
Mm-hmm.
And yet their means are so sort of alarming and similar, and alarmingly similar, and that it raises certain questions about how you tell the difference. So that's a difficult question, and kind of the central question a central question, at least, around violence that we all have to reckon with as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what I wanted to question was a sort of overly simplistic view of Buddhism as just simply nonviolent.
Right.
When in fact they are, you know, they're real intellectuals, and they are struggling with this intractable problem of violence and recognizing the extent to which it's terrible and to be avoided and yet unavoidable and part of life and needs to be reckoned with. So there's this ambivalence that we all feel toward violence, which can even take a form of sort of a fascination with violence, as we see in the movies today, and in the violent imagery in the myth itself. So, which is quite gory.
Yes.
And clearly they're in some way, some reason, reveling in it. So the first chapter really traces this struggle with violence and the attempt to come to terms with this problem back from the tantras, like you say, into the sutras and in particular Mahayana Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And I trace it back to the bodhisattvic idea of compassionate violence.
Mm-hmm.
That you find in some of the, well, most famously in the story of the Buddha in a previous life as the ship's captain. He is on the ship with, I think, 500 merchants, and discovers at some point that there's one guy on board who plans to murder everyone and steal all the treasure on board. And so the Buddha reasons that, well, if he tells everyone that this is this guy's plan, they'll kill him. And if he doesn't tell them, the guy will go ahead and kill them. And so the Buddha is sort of caught in this quandary, and where there's going to be violence one way or the other, no matter what he does. So in a kind of self-sacrificial way, he decides the only possible solution in such situations is for him to kill the thief, thereby taking on the bad karma of murdering the thief himself, rather than having the merchants take on that bad karma by killing the thief. So he does so, and then because of his pure selfless motivation at the last moment. He, of course, is actually sort of karmically saved, and the thief goes, I think, to a good rebirth, and everything works out nicely in the end.
Yes.
But it's only through, and this is sort of the paradox of that's involved in some of this violence, is it's only through the Buddha's, or the future Buddha, the Bodhisattva's willingness to endure the negative karma that he escapes the negative karma. In other words, he sort of accepts violence in order to transcend violence. So there's a sort of paradox there that I found interesting in terms of the ambivalence that I've already mentioned here,
right.
How violence is part of life, and yet you want to somehow transcend or escape it, and yet you can't escape it as long as you're trying to escape, because then you're doing violence to the idea of violence and sort of suppressing it, which can involve you in new forms of violence. And which, of course, ties into the larger Buddhist paradox of how do you defeat desire? When you want to defeat desire, you know, to desire, defeating desire is a paradox. And how do you accomplish such a thing? And so you find a similar kind of paradox with violence, where you want to suppress violence because it's awful, but that suppression itself can be in a form of violence. So that kind of paradox and ambivalence, all of these kind of moves are what I lay out in doctrinally in that first chapter, and that sort of sets the doctrinal stage for everything, the more historical chapters that follow after that.
Okay, so with that doctrinal backdrop, you move into the second chapter in which you're focusing on Tibet's age of fragmentation, or more specifically on the late 9th and 10th centuries. And here you argue that rather than being a time of decay, this period saw not only the continuation of Buddhism, but in fact the development of Buddhism in new and creative ways. And that central to this development was tantric myth and ritual. And furthermore, you also note that this development occurred sort of throughout Tibetan society, not just among a very small group of elites, as had previously been the case. Now, you state that prior to 900, the court was interested in the sort of non-localized, universal, utopian-like Buddhism, while the historical actors during the Age of Fragmentation were interested instead in application of Buddhism to a very local context. So there was this sort of previous interest in kind of a utopian, non-localized Buddhism, and then it turns into this very localized form. So I wanted to ask first, to what extent is this view of the Age of Fragmentation new? Is this something that is sort of increasingly accepted by scholars of Tibetan history, culture, Buddhism? And also I wanted to ask, in what way was tantric myth and ritual central to development of these sort of localized forms of Buddhism during this age?
Right. I think scholars previous to this book had certainly been questioning the traditional Tibetan historical accounts of this so-called dark age, age of fragmentation, or whatever you want to call it. The traditional accounts blame the whole thing on this demonic king, Longdharma, who supposedly around the middle of the 9th century closed down all the Buddhist monasteries and persecuted Buddhists and sort of plunged Tibet into darkness, sort of ending the glory days of the Tibetan Empire when Tibetans were in control of much of Central Asia. And so scholars had already, you know, many had already questioned this and pointed out that the reasons for the collapse of the empire were probably more complicated than a demonic king's, you know, lone influence. and the economic factors may have been at work, and that the collapse wasn't as precipitous, but in fact, it was a gradual process that happened over many decades.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe, I mean, there's probably a few exceptions, but I could say that what's new about what this book does is that it then takes the next step by saying, okay, but then what exactly happened in this age of fragmentation or dark age? Once the empire had collapsed, what made this, you know, again, the traditional histories say nothing happened. The lamp of the Dharma, the typical metaphor is the lamp of the Dharma, the flame of the Dharma went out or was extinguished. Yeah. And only at the end of the 10th century were the embers sort of rekindled.
Yeah.
And Buddhism began to flourish again. But so in the same spirit of sort of questioning the traditional accounts, maybe previous scholars had suggested, well, maybe it wasn't completely dark.
Mm-hmm.
But I really wanted to explore more fully what happened during those years. And mm-hmm. one of the results of my work with the Dunhuang manuscripts was to gradually recognize how many of them dated from this dark age.
Mm.
That in fact, you know, for example, Sir Oral Stein, who's the archaeologist who originally brought these manuscripts to London,
mm-hmm.
very quickly came up with this theory that, well, they probably date from the imperial period that ended with Long Dharma,
mm-hmm.
Because that's when the Tibetan Empire was at the height of its power and it controlled Dunhuang, and that's probably therefore when Tibetan was being written.
So this is early 9th century then?
Yeah. So okay. He thought, well, so most of these must date from the early 9th century.
Mm-hmm.
But gradually, as I was working on these manuscripts, it became apparent that especially the tantric manuscripts really almost all date to the 10th century.
Mm.
So I started realizing, you know, normally we think, well, we have very little literature from this age of fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
And so who knows what happened, because the monasteries had collapsed, the centralized political authority had collapsed, and we have little in the way of evidence.
Mm.
In fact, that's not entirely true. But if once you redate the Dunhuang collection, or large portions of it, you suddenly realize we actually have quite a number of windows into that period.
Mm.
And it struck me as particularly significant that so many of the tantric manuscripts dated from that period.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are some that date from the 9th century, but those they don't seem to contain so much tantric material.
I see.
Which fits with what you'd expect, because there were imperial decrees against the tantras, or
I see.
Against the public dissemination of the tantras. They wanted to control it within the court.
Right.
So, you know, what we find at Dunhuang implies that after the collapse of the empire and the centralized authority, then the Tibetans were sort of freed to plunge into the world of tantric Buddhism, and by the 10th century, you find tantric texts being written at Dunhuang.
Right. So one of the it seems like one of the central arguments in this chapter is the way in which the sort of political fragmentation was mirrored by a fragmentation of Buddhism, where this Tibetan myth and ritual, especially the subjugation of Rudra myth, were sort of applied to local deities, and in sort of catering to the interests of local patrons.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could discuss that, just describe that for the listeners a bit, because that seems quite central to not only this chapter, but also what you talk about in later chapters in which this sort of localized demon subjugation was later on sort of applied to Tibet as a whole.
Yeah. Well, so once Once you decide that, once you recognize that the imperial court collapses gradually and starting around the middle of the 9th century, and therefore sort of monastic and imperial control over Buddhism is gradually lost,
mm-hmm.
you end up with, and you accept the idea that Buddhism continued to be practiced in Tibet, you end up with a picture that is more about localized traditions of Buddhist practice that were not as dependent on large-scale monasticism that patronized by the court. So at Dunhuang, this gets into a larger issue of the nature of the tantric literature at Dunhuang too, which is actually the next book project I'm working on. When I came to the British Library to catalog these tantric manuscripts, I maybe somewhat simplistically thought, I'll be reading some tantras. And I got there, and in fact, there's basically one tantra and hundreds and hundreds of ritual manuals, sadhanas and vidhis and so on.
Huh.
And of course, this is lived religion. This is what people actually read and use, study notes, ritual manuals, and so on. And so in part, this opened my eyes to the important role that this kind of extra canonical genre of ritual manuals played in Buddhist history. In the Chinese canon, more of this kind of literature was preserved, but in the Tibetan canon, relatively little was preserved. There are a few very important sadhanas and so on that are by famous Indians that you find in the Tenjor, but for the most part, it's the tantras that are kept and some commentaries that completely ignores the fact that there were thousands and thousands of Tibetans with their own personal ritual texts, and none of this was preserved.
Yeah.
And so you end up with this kind of invisible, the invisible genre of very localized literature that's very flexible because it's outside the canon. You can slip in your own prayer, add your own comments in the margins as even a modern Buddhist today does.
Uh-huh, right.
And so actually this is the topic of a totally different book, but like this of course was going on in India too. And so the theme of that book is don't forget just how important this invisible genre was. Even if we can't see it, it's going on behind the scenes. And this genre of ritual manuals was actually sort of the petri dish where a lot of this creativity, ritual innovation, and so on could take place. And then occasionally was re-encapsulated by a new canonical tantra. And then new ritual manuals would spin out of that and continue to develop. So this is kind of how tantric ritual developed over time was through this invisible literature. So returning to the book at hand, what this also means is that a lot of the tantric ritual texts from Dunhuang reflect local interests as these rituals that are brought up from India are sort of copied and reinterpreted. And they, the Tibetans inevitably include some of their own interests. And this is, maybe even easier because we no longer have the watchful eye of large scale monasticism sort of watching over their shoulders.
I see.
And so Tibetans as they localized and sort of got into Buddhism at a local level, they were also free to kind of innovate in a way and develop their own sort of truly Tibetan traditions, which then became, you know, the cause of much anguish and consternation and suppression after the Dark Age, when the monasteries came back into being and authorities started saying, wait a minute, this isn't real Buddhism anymore. This has been mixed up with Tibetan Bun and other local concerns, and some of this you don't see in India. So this camp, this is corrupt. You know, this is not real Buddhism anymore. But, you know, my argument is that nonetheless, this was actually a very creative and important moment in the history of the Tibetan assimilation of Buddhism, and that later authorities, while they criticized these kind of moves that Age of Fragmentation Tibetans made, they very much benefited from the results, which is to say the sort of widespread conversion of Tibet into being a Buddhist country. So, yeah.
Thank you. So we got, okay, so I just wanted to move on a bit and look at, excuse me, in chapter 3, in which you focus on the liberation right, and you're looking specifically at how it's described in one particular Dunhuang manuscript. Now, the liberation rite itself entails the preparation of a sacred consecrated area or mandala, the placement of the sacrificial victim in the middle, the execution of the victim, be it a real victim or a sort of substitute victim, and the purification of the victim's consciousness. Every step of this rite appears to require various ritual performances and the successful maintenance of certain states of mind, I guess specifically by the officiant. That's a pretty gross oversimplification, but I wanted to, one of the sort of issues that you address is the problem of whether this is to be taken allegorically, whether this is a prescription for actual human sacrifice, or whether it's a ritual in which, as you described before, in which an effigy is substituted for a live sacrificial victim.
Yeah.
Maybe that's unfair to ask, because I suppose that's like the million dollar question or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah. In the most simplistic reading, that, you know, was kind of, you know, the sort of, yeah, like the Fox News, USA Today sort
yeah.
of question of what, you know, were people really doing Buddhist human sacrifice?
Yeah.
What I tried to do was to raise that question and keep it very much alive through the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
And to make it as real and worrying as possible, so that the reader felt some of the import of that question,
mm-hmm.
And thereby kind of used that as an entryway into these vexing kind of questions of violence and what's good violence and bad violence and real violence and imaginary violence and symbolic violence and what's the difference. And so what I tried to do was not to answer that question, but at the same time to insist that we must answer that question.
Yeah.
And that we're sort of ethically, you know, it's an imperative that we figure out, you know, in the cases of violence, you know, ethics are involved, and we need to make a judgment call about whether a certain violent act is good or bad. So I didn't want to sort of allow myself or my reader to get off the hook by saying, oh, we can't answer the question.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, I wanted to sort of push it and ride that line, worry that line a little more closely by pushing the limit and saying, maybe this really was happening, and
right.
we can't quite tell. And And I mean, I don't think this particular manual, it's possible to say for sure one way or the other,
mm-hmm.
Whether this is a case of live human sacrifice or just a symbolic ritual. But I think it's, you know, clear enough that in tantric religion, human sacrifice has happened over the centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And then that raises the question of, is that orthodox or was that just a misinterpretation
right.
and people abusing the teachings? But that very question re-involves us in the question of what is good and bad violence.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up in these sort of circles of reasoning that I wanted to explore and go round and round and round without kind of coming to any firm conclusions.
Right. I see what you're saying. Oh, okay. Well, no, thank that clarifies your approach to it. Thank you. So in the following chapter, you turn to the King Yeshe O. I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation, but King Yeshe O of Western Tibet and his edict of 990, in which he criticized certain tantric practices, in particular the liberation rite. Now, you argue that in this edict, which was not the only one he issued of this nature, you argue that this edict should be understood in the context of the need for the king to have a monopoly on sanctioned violence. Thus, he was not in theory opposed to symbolic violence, but he was opposed to actual violence as sanctioned by the liberation rite, or as apparently sanctioned by the liberation rite. So I wondered if you could just describe for the listeners King Yeshe O's views of the liberation rite, as well as his project to nominally separate, while in reality unify political and religious power. And obviously this is, as you very eloquently describe in the chapter, sort of related to larger questions of the relationship between Buddhism and the state and Buddhist history more generally.
Yeah, so, I mean, in a way, this chapter is kind of the pivot point of this book, and partly when I first encountered this Rudra myth and this manual from Dunhuang, this liberation rite, you know, if you know something about Tibetan history, the immediate temptation is to say, aha, this is the kind of stuff that later Tibetans complain about.
Mm.
And that this is the kind of stuff that these dark age Tibetans were doing in the darkness of their demonic ignorance. And therefore sort of dismiss it. This wasn't real Buddhism. So we can just kind of dismiss it and move on and continue on with our comfortable view of what Buddhism really is.
Mm-hmm.
And historically that kind of happened, except that it didn't entirely work. But so I took for myself personally, in my own research, I found myself wondering about this, and I started to recognize in myself my own kind of psychological issues around reckoning with violence in Buddhism.
Mm.
And the way that they played into historical narratives of Tibet.
Mm.
And I started to realize that that was also going on within Tibetans' writings themselves. So I frame that chapter, that's why I frame it as a sort of comparison between this King Yeshe O and
mm-hmm.
this Western, this British writer in, now I can't remember, it's a little 18th century India, and who's working on the Kalika Purana and a Hindu rite of human sacrifice, potentially. Anyway, so that sort of crossover, this pivot point between us as a reader, as a modern reader of these texts, and Tibetans as readers of their own tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took Yeshe Oh as a particularly nice case study because he stands also at a pivot point in Tibetan history where Tibetans are emerging out of this quote-unquote dark age,
mm-hmm.
and new centers of authority and monastic Buddhism are returning. So since writing the book, you know, I've been continuing to work on Yeshe Oh. Of course,
mm-hmm.
right when I sent off the book for the last time to the publisher, a new biography of Yeshe Oh appeared with all kinds of other edicts, which would have been lovely to have.
Mm.
And so I've been working on those and getting a better sense of his larger legal project, because basically not only did Buddhism collapse with the end of the Tibetan Empire, but also the rule of law. So
mm-hmm.
Yeshe Oh is sort of trying to recreate a legal system and monastic Buddhism at the same time, kind of on what he saw as a bit of a blank slate, which was the Dark Age.
Mm, right.
And he's working in Western Tibet. And so I found his writings particularly significant for how he was denigrating a lot of the local Tibetan practices around him in favor of, you know, monastic, sutra-based, ethical Buddhism.
Mm.
So it's a first kind of moment when you start to see a later Tibetan attitude about the Age of Fragmentation starting to emerge.
Mm.
And the fact that he's involved in law and reestablishing monastic Buddhism just seems significant in that the Dark Age is being darkened at this moment by someone who wants to use it as a kind of other against which he can then define his own pure monastic Buddhism. And put all of the negativity and corruption and violence into this other box and allow him to then move on and with his pure vision of monastic Buddhism intact.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I suppose that relates to something you talk about near the end of the chapter, where you talk about the type of Buddhism promoted by King Yeshe Oh, by Atisha and the Guge court, sort of emphasize the importance of monastic precepts and adherence to ethical behavior, and that this, or at least it was seen by Tibetans as emphasizing these facets of Buddhism, and how this sort of set the stage for a transformation of real violence into symbolic violence, and also for the development of certain Tibetan Buddhist orders later on that were interested more in sort of monastic discipline ethics and sort of doctrinal matters than in maybe tantric ritual. So this, now chapter 5 moves us forward in time to the 11th and 12th centuries. And, this was actually perhaps my, I found this chapter the most fascinating. And here you argue that that tantric violence, symbolic or otherwise, and the Tibetan view that the Age of Fragmentation was a dark ages of sorts, that both these ideas were instrumental in creating a new pan-Tibetan Buddhist identity. So I'd like to begin with the tantra demon subjugating that produced a plethora of narratives about local demons being pacified during the age of during the age of fragmentation. So you look at a text called the Pillar Testament, a composite work most likely dating from sometime between the late 11th and mid-12th centuries, and you argue that this sort of demon subjugation on a local level that occurred during the Age of Fragmentation in this new era was applied to the entire realm of Tibet in the form of the Rakshasi demoness legend and the construction of these 12 outlying temples that pin down the demoness, who is located, I guess, actually physically beneath the land of Tibet. So you seem to be talking about two things here. The first is the pacification of the entire realm of Tibet through temple construction, as just mentioned. And then the other is individual cases of temple construction in Tantric Buddhism, both in Tibet and India, and the way in which such construction, and particularly the pre-construction subjugation rituals, are both a set of actual ritual practices and also a sort of symbolic arena in which Buddhist masters demonstrated their abilities. So I guess what's my question here? I guess first, what is the Pillar Testament? If you could just describe what that is, and what is the Rakshasi demoness legend? I know that listeners who have studied Tibetan Buddhism will probably be intimately familiar with the latter of these two, but those whose expertise lies elsewhere may not be.
Yeah. So the Pillar Testament is a terma, a revealed text that supposedly describes King Son Sen Gampo's 7th century activities in building this network of border taming temples that were necessary to build over the limbs of this demoness of the landscape of Tibet before they could complete construction of the central sort of sometimes called cathedral of Tibetan Buddhism, which is in Lhasa and supposedly resides over the demoness's heart. So she had to be kind of pinned down before this central Rasa Trulnong could be completed. So what was the second
part? Right. And I should also mention for anyone who's listening has the book on page 114 in your book, you have a very nice picture of this, an image of this, actually sort of the land of Tibet with this demoness being and kind of pinned down by these, the figure of the demoness imposed on a sort of visual depiction of Tibet. Right. So the second question was what the Rakshasi demoness legend is. This idea that there's this sort of, demon underneath. So I guess what you seem to be saying here is that this was a sort of, what I understood was that this was a application of these kind of demon, this type of demon subjugation that had become so popular during the Age of Fragmentation. It was sort of a application of that at a sort of national level. National is not quite the word, but an application of it to the entire realm of Tibet. Was that correct?
Yeah. So the previous chapter about Yeshe'o, if that was a kind of case study of the writings of one individual, this king,
right,
in the late 10th century, then what this chapter does is kind of move into explore how some of those same themes of defining a negative demonic other against which pure monastic Buddhism could be, defined. Mm-hmm. That this then took on a larger, that rhetoric took on larger significance across all of Tibetan Buddhism. And this famous myth of Song Tseng Gampo, the first great Buddhist king in the 7th century,
mm-hmm.
established the heart, the central temple of all of Tibetan Buddhism in Lhasa, is understood within the same kind of terms of, there's this fundamental demonic identity of Tibet and Tibetans mm-hmm. that needs to be subjugated by the enlightening influence of Indian Buddhism that can sort of pin down the Tibetan character.
Mm-hmm.
And Janet Gyatso had written an article, I can't remember when now, in the 80s or 90s, just outlining some of this. So I was very much building on her work here.
I see.
But tracing it back more into Indian precursors and placing it within this larger context of the language, Tibetan Buddhist language around violence.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, to tell you the truth, this chapter is probably the shortest chapter in the book, and was originally part of the chapter that follows it on Buddhist warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what I was interested in doing was exploring two kind of spatial models that one finds in Tibetan Buddhism that I think relate to the Tibetan relationship with violence. And so this chapter outlines one in which the demon is pinned beneath the edifice of Buddhism. And you find that also, I trace it all the way back to stupas and so on in India, where you find relics, death, and sometimes demons pinned beneath stupas and buildings, temples. This raises the issue of foundation sacrifice, which is, whether it ever happened or not, is sort of a kind of rumors of this practice. You find all through Southeast Asia and Asia and into Europe and so on, of the idea of killing some innocent, often a child, and burying them in the foundation of a building, and somehow the spirit then of that sacrificed person infuses and strengthens the walls of the building.
Mm.
And I found that image interesting in terms of understanding this Rakshasi myth and the idea of building Tibetan Buddhism on violence, on demonic violence, and concealing it underneath, and yet somehow the power and strength and spirit of that demonic violence continues to lurk beneath and sort of infuse the edifice of Tibetan Buddhism.
Mm.
So in sort of symbolic terms, I found this kind of an interesting myth to explore.
I'm sorry. So, and as you clearly show in this chapter, that's linked to an idea of Tibetans being somehow spiritually inferior vis-a-vis in all things Indian, and also this idea that they're sort of somehow by nature demonic, and Tibet is and Tibetans are, and they must be sort of subjugated by Indian Buddhism. So we're getting close to the end, but I just wanted you to quickly contrast that with what you already alluded to, which was another spatial model, which is this topic of chapter 6, in which involves quite a different Tibetan self-conception.
Right. So then, we're sort of moving chronologically here. And so that moves to the Mongol conquest of Tibet and the sort of gradual extinction of Buddhism in India, and the way that Tibetans suddenly start to find themselves as the inheritors and authorities on true Buddhism.
Mm.
And so the spatial model that I explore in here is the idea that, which you can also find all the way back into the earliest Buddhist stupas in India, is the idea that Buddhism sits at the center and pushes, instead of pushing the demonic negative other underneath, it pushes it out to the boundaries, to the margins.
Mm.
There's that book Haunting the Buddha, by De Caroli, where he talks about how you had these Laukika spirits on the Vedicas and Toranas around Sanchi and so on in India. And in the same way in tantric mandalas, you have demons lurking outside of the Buddhist mandala who aren't allowed in, and are these worldly Laukika protectors of the tantric system. And so this whole model is a kind of alternative spatial model, but also potent in the Tibetan imagination. And so I used it to characterize this slightly later period where Tibetans found themselves now at the center of the Buddhist universe, with the Mongols at the edges and asking them what real Buddhism is, instead of Tibetans going to India and asking Indians. And there's sort of a role reversal. And with this, I also explored the issue of Buddhist warfare, I think was that same chapter, where the themes of violence and demonic demon subjugation take on a large scale kind of form in war magic on behalf of these Mongols, and sometimes on behalf of the Mongols, sometimes against the Mongols. And I think the chapter culminates with the fifth Dalai Lama's rise to power in the 17th century, which is very complicated and involves all sorts of political intrigue and details. But if you read the fifth Dalai Lama's own autobiographical account, he frames it very much in kind of mythic and ritual terms. And these are the terms that I've been exploring all through the book of demon subjugation and liberation rites and war magic being kind of the grand scale political sort of instantiation of these same issues.
Yeah. Well, we've taken a lot of your time. I want to ask you one final question. I also wanted, before I ask you, I just want to note to listeners that there's loads and loads and loads that we didn't cover, a lot about 19th and 18th century European depictions of Tibetan Buddhism and some 19th century Tibetan and 20th century Tibetan depictions of Tibetan Buddhism and violence. A lot of stuff about Indian precedents and Indian sort of comparisons that we didn't discuss. But you'll have to read the book to get all that. But as a final question, I just wanted to ask if there's something that you're working on at the moment. I know you've got a book under review with Columbia University Press, Through the Eyes of the Compendium of Intentions, The History of the Tibetan Ritual Tradition. Could you say a word about that or anything else that you're working on?
Yeah, that book, which that working title will probably be replaced. It's a bit clunky, and I haven't come up with a better alternative yet.
All right.
But that's basically just my dissertation reworked, maybe more interesting, at least to me, because that's sort of old news, and I should have done it immediately, but left it in the background for too long. But then there's this other book project that I mentioned on the early development of tantric Buddhist ritual as seen through the lens of these Dunhuang manuscripts. So in a way, this is kind of looking at Indian tantric ritual, but using these Central Asian manuscripts as the looking glass. And so, this is what I talked about before, where I ponder the larger issue of the role of the genre of ritual manuals and then look at how what we actually learn from this kind of time capsule of lived Buddhist religion at this crucial moment in the development of Tantra. I think, like I said, most of these manuscripts, these Tibetan tantric manuscripts, date from this so-called Dark Age or Age of Fragmentation in the 10th century, but they reflect a moment in the development of tantric Buddhism in India that's more like the end of the 8th, turn of the 9th century. So this is actually a kind of crucial moment in the development of tantric Buddhism, where you get a lot of the ritual structures, but a lot of the content is, and the moves that are made within those larger structures are still being worked out. So it's sort of an interesting stepping stone. And I think this material has a lot to offer our understanding.
Well, we'll look forward to that. And I just want to thank you very much for speaking with me today. And I wanted to thank all our listeners for tuning in. That's it for today's New Books in Buddhist Studies. See you next time.